Hello, and welcome to the New Books in Music podcast. In this episode, I speak with Shana Cheshti, the author of Modernity's Ear, Listening to Race and Gender in World Music. Our conversation explores the origin of the world music industry and how the rhetoric and philosophy that guided the earliest recordings of native and ethnic sounds continue to shape world music today. Well, tell me a little bit about yourself and how you decided to write Modernity's Ear, Listening to Race and Gender in World Music.
How did I decide and arrive at this book? It's been a meandering kind of road to get to this project. I started doing research for my dissertation around 1999, 2000. And that was, of course, I think, which is the case for so many of us, you know, a very different project. And at that time, I was really interested in this field or this genre that was, you know, kind of emergent at the time, known as Asian underground music. And I was really intrigued by what I was identifying at the time to be a diasporic sound that was very hybrid. And it was very much the result of, you know, generations of diasporic people migrating and settling in, you know, the kind of the seat of empire, so to speak, you know, and this is something that was inspired in me by Paul Gilroy's work with Jamaican sound systems. So when I discovered Asian underground music, I, you know, as an anthropology PhD student, I was really kind of trying to figure out, how do I study this thing? You know, do I live among the practitioners? Do I, you know, become a practitioner? So eventually I ended up at a record company that really specialized in this music. And that's where it all really began for me. And I really started to refocus my attention away from the artists and more toward the business. This also coincided with me kind of wearing a different hat as a musician and also seeking, you know, at that time, a career in the music business. So it was a really interesting period where my interests in the music business, you know, coincided at the level of an intellectual interest as well as from the perspective and position of a performer. Yeah, from there, I ended up working at the record company, and subsequently, I went on to really rethink a lot of things, because I ended up as an academic, I ended up in a position in an ethnic studies department. So some of the burdens that I felt as an anthropologist were sort of loosened. And so I started to develop an interest in, you know, periodizing my object of study differently than I think most anthropologists necessarily feel the pressure to do. So from there, it became, you know, a different project, one that really was interested in rethinking what even constitutes world music to begin with. Why do we only focus on the music industry? What does ethnomusicology have to do with this? And while we're on that topic, what does the Bureau of American Ethnology have to do with this? So it sort of circled back around to anthropology, but almost as an object of study. And from there, you know, I began to develop a larger thesis on this epistemological problem of how do we learn to listen? What do we hear? And that really was a fundamentally, you know, cultural question, but inflected by politics, race, gender, et cetera.
Well, one of the things that you write, kind of, it's almost in like the middle of your book, is you write the sentence that really jumped out at me. It said, "We are made of music." And that sentence just kind of made me stop in my tracks. I love this idea. And I was sort of, you know, getting all these mental images of what it means to be made of music. So, I don't know, what does that mean to you? And when you wrote that, like, what were you hoping to communicate?
Yeah, thank you for that question. I think that particular section of the book is really trying to understand why it is that music is supposed to bring us pleasure. And this is, you know, a truism in the music industry. You know, most commodities are successful when they are satisfying as consumable objects. And so, you know, the problem that I think the music industry has perpetually attempted to solve is that kind of problem of getting closer and closer and closer to the realism that music attempts to kind of create, you know, the fantastical world that music attempts to create. And that problem has been tackled in many different ways, you know, through hardware, through things like noise reduction and fidelity, but also through the kind of meanings that we bring to music. And so one of the particular interests that I have in my book is how do we interpret what we hear? And that I connect to this question of pleasure by really thinking about the way that the orifice of the ear has been imagined by the music industry, how it's been, you know, replicated in so many, you know, actual technologies, you know, in particular the phonograph, which very much looks like an ear and mechanically replicates the function of, you know, the ear. But also what the ear ultimately, I argue, represents within our kind of patriarchal system, which is an orifice that you know, produces pleasure when something enters it. So, you know, I use a lot of feminist theory in my work to understand pleasure, because I'm also, you know, a scholar of sexuality. And so I bring that literature to my interpretation of the ear. And ultimately, I, you know, use those ideas of, you know, sort of reproduction in trying to understand how music and sound are media that we use to reproduce versions of ourselves that might be idealized versions of ourselves.
Well, this is all very interesting. And so one of the things that I like about your book is it talks about how our ears are constructed to a certain extent. I mean, you know, on the one hand, ears are just sort of like the body, which for a lot of people means it's just the natural, the given. But as I'm reading you and hearing you talk, it seems you seem to be suggesting something different about how how we learn to hear and how these ears, our ears get constructed. So if you maybe talk a little bit about maybe within the world music context, how our ears have been constructed.
Well, you know, this idea occurred to me relatively early on in my ethnographic field work at the World Music Record Company, when I repeatedly heard the, you know, employees and executives at the label referring to their consumers only as listeners. And, you know, I was struck by this. You know, they, you know, the notion of the consumer is obviously very sterile. And so I initially thought, well, they're, you know, they don't want, this is an independent record label, a small record label, kind of a boutique niche place. They don't want to alienate themselves from their customers by referring to them as customers or consumers. So instead they refer to them as listeners. But over time, I kind of I've developed a different set of ideas around that. And in particular, I began to, especially when I started to really construct the arc of the book, I began to think about the importance of listening over the course of, you know, the long 20th century, so to speak, which is when this particular technique of listening, if you will, became cultivated. And I was really struck by the importance of archiving sound as a practice within modernity. And, you know, obviously the music industry is one archive of sound. But prior to that, the federal government took it upon itself to really initiate this large scale, what we now understand to be the industrial practice of archiving sound, but in the form of what, you know, anthropologists and ethnomusicologists call salvage ethnography, or what we understand popularly to be song catching. And, you know, this was a very important moment where representations of Native Americans and African Americans came to be, you know, very much inscribed and fixed in the archive in ways that were unprecedented, because prior to that, these people were only represented through proxy, either in, you know, logs kept by masters or in the rare occasion, there were, of course, slave narratives that would be dictated to, you know, a biographer. But in the case of Native Americans, it was often missionaries or anthropologists who would chronicle them for the archive. And this moment of audio recording really was the first moment in which, you know, we are led to believe that we see real representations of Native Americans and African Americans. And instead, one of the questions that I pursue in the book is, to what degree are these audio recordings necessarily that different from the logs kept by slave masters or the colonial archives that we often consult to write indigenous history? Why is it that we think that sound is somehow more real? And it's through that inquiry that led me to this question of listening, that there's a way in which we imagine some kind of unmediated truth when it comes to recorded sound. And I think it's partially inspired by a desire that the listener has to experience that authenticity. And I think that desire very much propels the contemporary music industry, just as it did, just as it propelled the early, you know, song catchers, this desire for authenticity. And what I ultimately argue is, and I don't really think this is a spoiler because, you know, it's there's a lot of connective tissue, of course, between, you know, these points. But what I ultimately argue is that really what the listener hears is the listener's own desire rather than the authentic sound that they are in search of. And that's what I attempt to chronicle in the book.
So maybe in kind of making a link between some of those early song catchers and then what's happening in today's world music industry is, what were some of the ways in which the early song catchers were actually mediating the sounds that they were recording? And then how do we see that sort of maybe being translated or happening or being reinscribed in more recent world music recordings?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I think that question kind of, you know, integrates a lot of the stakes that I have in writing the book. You know, one thing that the record company where I worked, and I call this company Kinship, but that's a pseudonym. One of the things that they are known for is their sound, is the Kinship Records sound. And the company, you know, promotes itself through this idea that there is a coherence in sound across, you know, many of their recordings, even though the actual, you know, musicians on the recordings may come from very different places in the world. And I, you know, even before beginning my research, I could hear that sound. I could hear that stylistic signature across these very different kinds of music. And I found that to be so curious. I, you know, interviewing others about the label, they also, and sometimes disparagingly so, they could hear that sound. And sometimes it would be very off-putting for listeners who were in search of more of like a, what they imagine as a traditional, let's say, Indian raga, as opposed to the world music hybrid version of an Indian raga. So, you know, I'm scratching my head trying to understand, how do you create and construct this coherent sound? And of course, in contemporary music, you know, the producer is thought to be that connective, you know, that thread that connects these different sounds. And that's, sure, that is absolutely one way of thinking about it. But that nevertheless still raises the question of, how does the producer impart a signature that then becomes audible to the listener, right? So when I started doing archival research in the wax cylinder recordings made by early comparative musicologists, who are, you know, the group of recordists that we typically associate with the term song catcher, I began to recognize continuity across their recordings. I began to identify differences between recordings of one comparative musicologist compared to another. And at the same time, I was experimenting with my own recordings as a part of my research. I was conducting soundscape recordings throughout San Francisco, which is where the record company is, where I was doing my ethnographic field work. And listening back to these soundscape recordings while also listening to the music at the record label and also listening to these early Wax Cylinder recordings, I had this aha moment where I realized that what I could hear in my own recordings was my own experience of listening in real time while I recorded. And in addition to just sort of being conscious of the machinery and et cetera. And so the more I started researching into the techniques used by song catchers, I began to realize that, you know, song catchers were very much like contemporary record producers. Song catchers would identify a particular member of a community as the soloist who would be featured on a recording, or in, you know, the case of later ethnomusicology, you know, ethnomusicologists could identify a particular performer in the context of a penitentiary, whom they thought most represented the genre of prison blues. And so I learned more about some of the limitations imposed just by the technology itself, that a cylinder can only be recorded on for such a short amount of time. And when you think about sacred forms of music, they're typically not short. Sacred forms of music that are performed in ceremonial contexts, you know, typically are quite long. And cylinder recordings were often less than 2 minutes. And so there were so many constraining limitations that the recordist had to kind of negotiate, much like contemporary producers have to negotiate. And so then I began to realize that same signature that we can hear in contemporary recordings of the producer, we can also kind of perform an archaeology of these recordings from, you know, 1909, for example, or 1898, and actually find similar signatures that are present, which leads me to the argument that, you know, the sound, the coherent sound is really the sound of the recordist, and not the sound that we actually ascribe to the recording itself, which is the sound of the performers.
So as you were talking and kind of beautifully describing sort of how you came to this realization, one of the things that kind of jumped out in my mind is there also this transformation of music from being something that was social and communal to something that becomes sort of the product of like the soloist or a single player? And do we see that also happening in sort of the world music scene, where because it's easier to maybe commodify like a singer or a performer over a group, do we see some of that happening?
Wonderful question. I absolutely would agree that's what we begin to see happening. You know, we see that in general, I think, you know, when we scale, you know, when we kind of open our frame and consider further back in popular music prior to, you know, audio recording as we know it today. But think about the popular forms of the 19th century, where we move into smaller and smaller spaces. You know, I'm thinking of chamber music, which is a very small scale version of what we saw in the prior centuries. And one of the reasons for this is that this corresponds with an emerging bourgeoisie who can afford to even have a chamber, where they then hire musicians into to sort of perform in front of their social circles to illustrate, you know, their nouveau riche, you know, sort of comeuppance. So as we move into the 20th century, we, of course, see a shift from technologies of simply you know, the scoring of music and sheet music as the predominant mode for popular music. And by popular, of course, I'm talking about the music industry. As we know, popular music is not necessarily recorded music, right? Popular music is the music that, you know, the troubadour sort of orchestrates a community around. But in the music industry setting, popular music is that genre that, you know, has a kind of monetary value that we can attach to it. And that in the 19th century was predominantly organized around sheet music. Later, of course, we have the player piano, which is sort of the transition from sheet music to what we understand to today's popular music. But as we move into the early 20th century, you begin to see the preference for the soloist. And, you know, there are different arguments around why this is. You know, on the one hand, it's cheaper, of course. But on the other hand, the technology is not capable of replicating with high fidelity the complexity of large scale, you know, orchestration. So the soloist becomes the person who can stand close to the microphone and who can therefore present the highest quality sound for that recording event. And of course now, you know, we continue to feature that. And, you know, when you begin to kind of look at the popularization of world music, which, you know, really develops more of a global traction after the 1960s, you see this preference for the soloist. And you begin to see the featuring of stars who, you know, without their band, of course, could not, perform. And so I think there's all, you know, as myself, as a musician, I've always found it, I've always interpreted, you know, the artist's relationship to this stardom, especially in the world music context, with a great deal of ambivalence, because, you know, in the third and fourth world, there's this sort of expectation that, you know, when a member of a community makes it out, so to speak, you know, they have the responsibility to pull up the people behind them. And, you know, when you have the featuring of a soloist, I've seen in so many cases where that becomes anathema to the way that communities imagine how they relate to these figures. But, you know, music is not an exception. In the 20th century, we begin to see this privileging of, you know, the autonomous individual as colonialism really takes hold. You know, you see this radical shift that really causes a lot of, you know, crises in society around the world. The shift from communitarianism to individualism. So music is just one domain where we can chronicle that emergence, but we can look at the nation state, you know, we can look at, of course, economics. You know, we can look at the nuclear family, which is a modern invention that privileges, you know, the kind of autonomous individual. So, yeah, I think we see in music something that is reflective of other, you know, social, cultural, economic, you know, and governmental processes. And, you know, then you have the formation of these stars, and these stars then, you know, they spawn progeny that then create these dynastic communities in world music. So you can look in most world music traditions around the world and see dynasties forming around these individuals. And I would argue that prior to the 20th century, there was no such thing as that. You know, you had musical families, but music was thought to be It had a different social value and economic value than it does in the 20th century. So, yeah, you see this really interesting merging of these forces in the context of the soloist.
And kind of to move kind of from the soloist back to the listener, because I was the listener is really a key focus of your book. But I think this ties in interestingly is there's been a lot of writing about music that has to deal with issues of appropriation. But you kind of challenge that, and you talk about the idea of incorporation as maybe being a more fruitful way of understanding what's happening. And I think in some ways, I think this is still rooted to this process of where individuals are sort of disconnected from their communities and they become the focus. And so let's say, what happens to the listener when they incorporate these different sounds?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I'm really struck by how diffuse world music has become in the 21st century as compared to the 20th century, where it still, I think, was kind of compartmentalized, you know, as very much sort of the other music. And you rarely, you know, very, very rarely, and of course we can think of the most famous examples, but you very rarely encountered, you know, this merging of world music with popular European and American musics. Unlike today, where, you know, there's a degree of cachet that a world music reference brings to a popular musician in Europe or you know, or the U.S. Or, you know, really the Americas, I would say. You know, I'm thinking of, you know, contemporary, you know, psych folk artists, you know, coming out of South America who also engage in these practices. So, you know, in the book, I take up the case of Vampire Weekend, which is, you know, a contemporary band out of New York City. And they're imagined as, you know, very kind of straightforward indie rock, except that they're described as having Afropop flourishes. And I was struck by why and how a band, you know, with no obvious ties to West Africa, is kind of laying claim to this history. And so I pursue Vampire Weekend as an example through which I explore this idea of appropriation. And I start, you know, that chapter by reflecting on this really interesting photograph that I used to, just kind of casually observe as I would come in and out of the office at Kinship Records, where I did my ethnographic field work. And this was a very famous photograph. It's called Harlem 1958, I believe. The name is, for some reason, not on the tip of my tongue right this moment. But it's a photograph of sort of some of the most famous bebop musicians in New York City coming together on one day in Harlem. And, you know, the photograph is sitting inside the lobby at the record label where I worked, surrounded by world music records. And, you know, I thought it odd because there was no other reference to jazz at this record company, no, you know, obvious relationship to this photograph. And so I began to really think about how this critique of appropriation, which has been waged at world music and the non-world music artists who employ world music, you know, people like Paul Simon, Peter Gabriel. I was reflecting on how that idea of appropriation, you know, if we really follow it to its logical conclusion, it's not a very helpful case for us to make if we're trying to advocate for, you know, cultural patrimony. Music is a really, really difficult medium and object with which to say, okay, this is unproblematically the property of X community. Okay. Music is that one thing that, you know, is very difficult to obviously and easily argue for such proprietary claims. So instead, I begin to reflect on this photograph that I was just talking about as possibly Kinship Records' own way of reconciling their relationship to this idea of appropriation, that really appropriation is a thing of the past. What the record company that I worked with kind of described what they described what they did as a collaboration between, you know, first world musicians and third world musicians that was very much an equal exchange. So they rejected this idea of appropriation and made the argument for, you know, reciprocal egalitarian exchange. And in my pursuit of that claim, I was also holding on to this idea I spoke to earlier about how the producer's imprint is always audible to the listener of world music. And you know, this is often the case with musics that are referred to as hybrid, where almost any listener can distinguish what might be called hybrid world music from traditional world music. And that's because of the presence of what are called these modern production values. So as I begin to kind of pursue this larger question around Vampire Weekend, I begin to explore how they also reject this idea of appropriation. And instead, they make the argument that they came to, you know, West African high life music very honestly through their record collections and through their parents' record collections. And it became this kind of revised story of cultural patrimony where, you know, the record collection becomes the archive of culture for, you know, the particular individuals in Vampire Weekend that I'm discussing. And in building my argument, I develop upon this idea that I borrow from Sigmund Freud, a psychoanalytic idea that he calls incorporation. And Freud's theory of incorporation is basically that we take into our bodies that which we want to make our own and essentially destroy another's claim to. Okay. And he describes incorporation as taking place, you know, through the mouth, but also through the ear. And I, that really struck me, as, you know, precisely what, you know, what I was witnessing happening in this transformed kind of contemporary world music industry, that it was no longer the case that, you know, these musics were considered traditional. They were now considered hybrid forms that came to these listeners through noble and respectable methods, as opposed to through theft, which is typically the way that appropriation is thought of. Building upon the idea of the ear, that the listener, by taking into his or her body these sounds, incorporates the cultural and racial and historical makeup of those sounds into him or herself. So, the idea of incorporation is really kind of me sort of percolating the prior chapters into an analysis of this transformed sense of appropriation in world music.
So this really led to me kind of one of the central dilemmas that I had as I was sort of kind of finishing up your book, which is, to me, it seems like, is there an ethics or sort of an ethical rules or guidelines when a listener like myself listens to world music? Like, are there sort of ethical considerations to the kinds of incorporations that I should be thinking about, whether these are racial or gendered, and even for musicians, are there some kinds of incorporations that are too much or not enough, or is there ways that you can incorporate in an ethical way or an unethical way? I get the impression that you've probably thought about this quite a bit, and so could you maybe share a little bit about that?
Yeah, that's a great question, and I have to apologize at the outset that I don't have a great answer. first and foremost, I would argue that my book is not prescribing the right way to listen. Okay. And it's really more a snapshot, if you will, of a contemporary phenomenon that I'm witnessing and a part of. So, you know, I discuss in the book all the ways in which I too engage in the pleasures of listening. And so the last thing I would hope would be a takeaway from reading my book is the idea that, there's a right way to listen and a wrong way to listen. Instead, the predicament that I'm taking note of is one that's very much overdetermined. And my hope is that by taking note of it, we can begin to reflect on it, ask questions of it, find ways of relating to it differently. I can talk a little bit about some of my more recent research where I am pursuing that more so. But really my book is about, you know, the music industry and the particular practices that the music industry has promoted for, you know, over 100 years. And I would argue that there are few of us who can claim to listen to any recorded music in a way that doesn't, you know, flirt with this prescribed way of listening that the industry has tailored for us. That's not to say that there aren't, alternative ways of listening, which there absolutely are, that there aren't kind of counter publics, you know, is one way of thinking about it, for these musics, which there absolutely are. But that's not what my book is about. And instead, you know, what I'm interested in is what this kind of listening is doing for us. What is the value that it brings to our lives? And I argue that it is precisely how we imagine ourselves as modern. To listen differently would really challenge us in such a profoundly fundamental way that it has implications for so many other things beyond listening, right? And so in the epilogue to my book, I kind of begin to ask this question. I begin to pursue this by thinking about what I call a parallel kind of radical history to modernity's ear. And I think about that through a set of recordings made by Zora Neale Hurston, who is most well known as a member of the Harlem Renaissance, and an author, a playwright, a socialite, and, you know, lesser known work. She was a worker for the WPA in the 1930s, conducting audio recordings and field research for the Works Projects, Works Progress Administration, which was a New Deal effort that, you know, was promoted by the federal government. So in her role as a WPA recordist, she did something very, very odd, which was to record herself singing all of these kind of African-American folkloric songs that she encountered in Georgia and Florida, and that she herself, you know, had been exposed to growing up in Florida. So I begin to kind of think about what would our listening be like if we instead had this alternative archive through which we learn to listen. And I refer to her practice as a kind of infidelity, which went against the emphasis on audio fidelity that has really defined audio recording, you know, in the history of audio recording, continues to define audio recording. And fidelity is really a preoccupation with realism, with a one-to-one relationship between the recorded sound and the sonic event. And Hurston rejected this. She rejected this desire for realism. And I interpret that as a rejection of the archive's desire for authentic representations of African-American folklore. So, you know, really the book ends with this quandary of, you know, what would happen if we had more of a sense of this alternative history? Would we feel that we could engage in different forms of listening than necessarily one that kind of derives pleasure from authentic, you know, representations of fill in the blank, suffering, you know, angst, anger, coyness, you know, titillation, seduction, et cetera, all the ways that sound can signify. What if we had a different form of relating to the pleasure that we derive from listening that didn't hinge upon that, the authenticity of the other? And really that's the question that I end on. And I can't possibly be expected to answer that. And I don't attempt to answer that, but really I try to ask that and hope that it inspires that question in others.
Well, one of the questions I did have, which is, I was also really interested in learning sort of what is happening to world music labels really in the last like 3 to 6 years with iTunes and YouTube, Pandora. It seems like the whole recording industry has changed. And I was wondering if, especially like YouTube, but how does that even change what they're producing? Because I know a few points you talk about, even like album covers and kind of like liner notes. And I know when I talk to my students today, they don't even know what liner notes are.
Right.
So I don't know. Do you have a sense of how this is maybe changing world music in general, but even perhaps even that signature style or signature sound that you were talking about earlier?
Yeah, you know, I'm really very eagerly following this trend myself, and don't feel like I have enough perspective to really offer, you know, incisive analysis, but I can share some observations that I've made, which are, on the one hand, you know, these small scale boutique record companies, which, you know, there were quite a few of in the 1990s and, you know, early 2000s, they've very much struggled to survive in every genre, not just world music. What I've observed is that those that have survived have either cultivated a kind of nuanced business model for distribution, and or that is coupled with the sort of creation of a sense of their expertise as curators. Because one of the outcomes of, you know, the contemporary kind of diversification of music delivery methods is that there is an overwhelming amount of music out there. And, you know, people, especially people who aren't, you know, sort of teenagers in front of their computers constantly searching and searching and searching, you know, people kind of grumble about how difficult it is to find music. And so one way that world music record companies have sort of survived that very treacherous transition from, you know, the CD to, you know, the MP3 to streaming is by brokering in an expertise that they then claim allows them to curate a particular kind of experience for the listener. So that boutique kind of expertise as curator is what I think is becoming emphasized with world music record companies in particular. As far as, you know, what are some of the ramifications of the different methods of distribution, you know, streaming, for example, I think the outcome of that is really where some of the most interesting and exciting aspects of world music are right now. So for example, you know, you begin to see new networks establishing around the world that are organized around particular genres. So, you know, global hip hop networks, global house music networks. And so whereas it used to be that world music was sort of like the old film industry, organized around nations, you know, so you had the thing known as national cinemas. World music tended to be organized around, you know, Malian music, Iranian music, Brazilian music. There's a shift taking place now to genres that then parse out into specific iterations that are linguistically varied. So that you have, you know, K-pop, where K-pop that travels, of course, way beyond Korea. And K-pop is a complicated example. I'm sorry I even brought that up because, you know, we would be hard pressed to necessarily, you know, pigeonhole it as one genre only, because within K-pop, you know, you do have Korean hip-hop too. So anyway, my point is that one interesting, you know, outgrowth of this that I'm observing is that there is kind of more of an opportunity for artists to network together and to reimagine genre. And language seems to be playing a new and important role, more so than nation state. So that's sort of, something that I'm observing, especially as a teacher, you know, as a professor, introducing some of these concepts to my students. You know, one of the things that I find fascinating is the feedback that I get from them. And I have a very international body of students, and I, you know, am just amazed by, you know, what they're listening to and how they're accessing it. And so this, yeah, I'm kind of in the process of really still, you know, trying to figure out where this is headed.
Well, thank you so much for taking so much time and just really just explaining and exploring the ideas you talked about in your book. This has just been fantastic. But before we go, is there anything that you're currently working on?
Yeah, no, and thank you for the opportunity. It's been a pleasure talking to you. And just, you know, in closing, I'll say I have several projects that I'm working on. One of them is a book project on Zora Neale Hurston's media work, including her audio recordings, as well as a number of ethnographic films that she made. And I'm really interested in, you know, the important innovations that she was engaging in the 1920s and 30s, using multimedia to do ethnographic research. So that's one of my books. It's called We See with the Skin. The other project I'm working on is a book for the imprint 33 and a Third, which is a book series focused on albums. And the particular project that I'm writing is Switched on Bach by Wendy Carlos. And this is a project that I've been really interested in pursuing for a long time. I, you know, play Moog synthesizers, and Wendy Carlos is someone who really made the Moog synthesizer a household name. And so I'm working on that, and I hope to have that out in early 2018. And yeah, those are my two main book projects right now.
Well, great. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
You have been listening to the New Books in Music podcast. Today I've been talking with Roshana Cheshti, the author of Modernity's Ear, Listening to Race and Gender in World Music. This is your host, Richard Scherr. Thank you for listening.